This evening I have Jose Figueroa, who was born in El Salvador and had immigrated to Canada 13 years ago. He has three Canadian-born children, and just last May 2010, he had been given a deportation order because, according to the Canadian Border Services Agency, his past membership with Farabundo Marti, Front for National Liberation, makes him inadmissible to Canada. Thank you for joining us on Migrant Matters this evening, Jose.
Thank you very much.
So we're here today to learn more about Jose and the We Are Jose tour, which is why he's here in Guelph today. There's a Cross Canada tour. And would you like to speak more about who you are and what the campaign is about?
Thank you very much. Well, first of all, my name is Jose Figueroa. I am from El Salvador. We came into Canada over 13 years ago. We made a refugee claim, and basically we have made a life here in Canada. We have three Canadian-born children, and one of them, the eldest, was diagnosed with autism. We came in Canada because our life in El Salvador was in danger. And we thought of Canada as a place where we could start up a new life and look for some kind of safety. I think that it is very important that people know that there are many issues in this case. Right now, the process is at a point where the Minister of Public Safety has to make a decision based on Section 34.2 of the RPA, and we have learned that he could take 7 to 9 years to decide on this situation. We have already been 13 years here in Canada, and we cannot wait any longer.
And the IRPA is Canada's Immigration and Refugee Protection Act.
That's what it is, yes.
How was your life in El Salvador before you immigrated to Canada in 1997?
Well, when I was in El Salvador, I was a member of a student union at the University of El Salvador. Our role at the university was basically to talk to people once for their academic interest, and also to raise awareness of what the situation in El Salvador was in that period of time. We're talking about the decade of the 80s, when there was a civil war in El Salvador, and there were so many people's rights being violated by the regime in El Salvador. We were part of the student union, and as such, we helped as other members of different organizations to push for the peace agreements in El Salvador to be accomplished. And that was done, and what we accomplished in 1992, January 16, 1992.
You mentioned the group Farabundo Marti, Front for National Liberation, and what most people know as the acronym FMLN. Can you talk about FMLN and why many people had chosen to support and continue to choose to support FMLN, and why they were opposing El Salvador's government during the Salvadorian Civil War?
Well, I think that it is very important to review the past. And really, the CBSA officers, they don't really have an accurate knowledge about the Salvadoran history.
Yeah, and CBSA stands for the Canada Border Services Agency.
Yes. FMLN as an organization is it came as a response of the Salvadoran people to basically defend themselves against the repression that was being brought in El Salvador. We have to remember that in August 28, 1981, there was this declaration of two countries, Mexico and France. They made a declaration concerning the alliance FMLN and FDR as a belligerent political force that was trying to get some changes in El Salvador. And as such, the Salvadoran struggle was legitimate.
And the FDR stands for the Frente Democrático Revolucionario, or Revolutionary Democratic Front, which is the major representative of a grouping of social democratic parties in El Salvador, established in 1980. Can you talk about your work with FMLN in the past, so decades ago?
Well, as many popular organizations in El Salvador, we're talking about workers, students, peasants, and many other organizations. We were basically trying to achieve some changes in Salvadoran society, which was undergoing a tremendous repression. And many members of the different organizations had some kind of link to FMLN, because FMLN was basically pushing for those changes to happen. So my role as a student union, as I said before, it was to open up the minds of people about our own reality. The regime was using all means to in order to confuse people. And we knew what's going on. We were witness of the atrocities that were happening in El Salvador. Just remember that it was the Salvadoran government through the Death Squad that were the authors of the assassination of Archbishop Romero. It was a battalion of the armed forces of El Salvador, the battalion Atlacat, that made a massacre of more than almost 1,000 people in El Mozote. It was the Salvadoran government of that time through the armed forces that killed 6 Jesuit priests at the University of Central America. And the Salvadoran conflict left over 80,000 people. So this really will wake people up. You know, they needed some changes so that more people will be saved in this situation. So our role in El Salvador, in the student union, was basically to open up the minds of the people to our own reality.
Could you just briefly let listeners know who Archbishop Oscar Romero is?
Well, Archbishop Romero, you said that right. Archbishop Romero is, even though he was assassinated over 31 years ago, Archbishop Romero is still in the mind and in the hearts of many Salvadorans. He was somebody who spoke for the people. He was witness of what the Salvadoran government was doing to the people, and he spoke for them. And just after 81 years, as I said, his messages have been on the minds of many Salvadorans. As a matter of fact, we used his many homilies as evidence during the proceedings of this case. Why did we do that? Well, basically because those homilies are like a complement of the Truth Commission that made a report in 1993 after the peace agreements were done. And when you study Archbishop Romero's life, his homilies, you will be able to understand why FMLN came to be and why FMLN cannot be considered as a terrorist organization.
I think it's important to have revisited this struggle of the people of El Salvador during the Civil War to understand why you came to Canada that supposedly is a peace-supporting haven. Let's talk about the allegations that have been brought upon you by the Canadian Border Services Agency.
Yeah, well, I think that is very important. Those allegations, they are based on Section 34.1 of the RPA. That's the Immigration Refugee Protection Act. I think in some ways, this section of the RPA is very problematic. It is problematic because since the Immigration Act doesn't have a clear definition of what terrorism is, they are basically borrowing a definition that is contained on the Criminal Code of Canada. When they are doing that, they basically are taking a definition that is too broad, that when applied to anybody, they could categorize any individual as terrorism. So this is something that needs to be brought up, because even though the allegations, they might say that they are applying the law, but not necessarily they are applying justice. So people need to understand that justice and the law are not the same situation, are not the same concept. So going back a little bit on what the allegation is, Section 34.1, as I said before, it says that a foreign national is inadmissible on security grounds based on their membership with an organization that there are reasonable grounds to believe is or was a terrorist organization. The officer that made this 44 report, the report that brought up the allegations to life, he made an opinion. It's a discretionary opinion. In some ways, the CBSA officer somehow has more power than the minister themselves. If the CBSA officers that made the decision would have come with this opinion, more likely that nothing would have happened. And now we have this situation about Section 34.2 that they are alleging that gives this exemption. But if you put a little more of logic into this situation, the immigration law is given to some individuals that have no knowledge about some realities, too much power to decide on the life of other people. In this case, we have my family has been undergoing through a lot of situations, like we have been deprived from medical coverage for over 13 years just because somebody there in CBSA decided to make an opinion about this situation. So I think that it's a very complex topic, but it needs to be kind of separated in different parts so that people can understand that the rights of many, many people can be violated or can be affected by the way the immigration law is stated.
Yes, it's very worrying that the Canadian Border Services Agency has the power of the state to deport based on their discretion. To continue with the effects of these allegations being brought upon you, including the effects on your family, heavily connected with that, by way of being a root cause, is the systemic processes that you have to face that because of this erroneous allegation that you were part of a terrorist group, the difficulties of the systemic processes that you faced, such as having to renew permits every so often. You mentioned the lack of medical care coverage that you'd have to pay for yourself, whereas the government should be paying for it. And can you talk more about that? I also remember you talking about child benefits. The government hasn't covered any of that.
Well, it seems that during these 13 years that we have been here in Canada, the only right that we have had is to pay our taxes every year. And even though, like, in 2004, our application for an HNC application, which is an application for humanitarian and compassionate grounds, was approved in principle. We know now that back then we should have been given a temporary resident permit, which has been held by CBSA for all of this time. If we had had that temporary resident permit, basically we would have been able to apply for medical coverage. During all these years, I have been working hard, and I was able to pay any premiums that the medical coverage required. Yet when we applied for that, we were said that we cannot be given the medical coverage because we had no status, which means that we have been here in Canada in a limbo, basically, with no status at all, and many of our rights as human beings have been denied to us through this system. Another thing, for instance, like we as family, we should be allowed the family allowance. And, well, isn't this something that has to do that will benefit my family? Here in Canada, some people are talking that family is something very important for them. The protection of the family as a union or unifying families is very important, but they are bringing up allegations or proceedings of deportation to many people that basically are separating families. And in this case, we have my kids. They are Canadians. They have rights in Canada. Now they are being threatened to be separated from their parents. As a responsible parent, I have the right to stand up and to fight for the rights of my kids. They are my kids. Nobody can separate me from them. So from a human part of situation, it's just very troublesome to hear that a government is able to disregard these rights from kids. Canada is signatory of the International Convention on the Rights of the Children. Well, would that mean that when these kind of allegations are brought against somebody, they are taking precedent over these other rights? The best interest of the children is something very important in these cases, and they are being disregarded.
If you do get deported, what are the implications for your family?
Well, first of all, my wife and I, we were teachers back in our country. We left the safety that could have provided there because our lives were in danger. Now, I have three children. One of them is autistic. Getting back into El Salvador for him will be very traumatic. He will have to be adapting to an environment to which he is not prepared to. He can barely speak English. He has some kind of a help here in Canada for his disability. That help cannot be obtained in El Salvador. So here we're talking about the future of my children. On the other hand, they are basically forgetting that as human beings, they are individuals. They are forgetting the individuality. My wife, for instance, she's a Salvadoran, and because she's my wife, she's to be deported with me. Well, what problem has she caused? I haven't caused any problem, neither she has. So there are so many aspects in this. And on the other hand, there is my dignity as a human being. You know, the allegations that they are bringing up to me is because I was a member of an organization that they believe is a terrorist organization. I don't think that all Salvadorans that they have elected an FMLN member as a president, they agree with the Canadian government. There's this contradiction, you know. The definition of terrorism for Salvadorans obviously is different from the definition of terrorism that the Canadian government has. So I think that this is a question that all Canadians should be asking to the Canadian government. Because even within the Canadian government itself, there is this contradiction. The judicial is saying one thing and the executive is saying the other thing. They cannot be just hiding these logical questions from the people.
Because, yes, currently the FMLN is the democratically elected government, yes.
Well, like I said before, FMLN has been a legitimate political party since 1981. And even 1992, it was confirmed through the peace agreements in El Salvador. They were, remember the peace agreements that were signed, and they were supported by the Canadian government. In 1992, the Canadian government, through the United Nations, they gave their word that they were going to help the Salvadorans consolidate the peace agreement. When they are bringing this kind of allegations, basically what they are doing is they are backing up their support that they pledged to give to all Salvadorans. And to me, it's just illogical that they are presenting this type of allegations, precisely because the Canadian government has diplomatic relations with the FMLN. They just were working on a trade agreement. And with that, they are basically stressing an opinion that the FMLN is a democratically elected government. So I don't think that Canada can have it both. Either they consider FMLN as a terrorist organization, or they consider it as a democratically elected government. So that's something that needs to be really, really explained to the Canadians and to the world.
The Canadian government is, in your case, categorizing the FMLN as a terrorist organization and hence associating you with terrorism, and that's why they won't accept your refugee claim. So why else is it that it's wrong for Canada to label the FMLN as a terrorist organization?
Well, I think that the reason why Canada cannot be labeling FMLN as a terrorist organization, not even the United Nations have done so. During these proceedings, we presented evidence and we went back to 1946. You know, the United Nations Security Council, they will issue a resolution whenever they see a terrorist act. They have done so in so many cases. So we researched since 1946, and there is not a single resolution from the United Nations Security Council labeling FMLN as a terrorist organization. There are only about a few resolutions concerning El Salvador, and they were given during the process of the peace agreements that were being signed. But if you review those resolutions, they never referred to FMLN as a terrorist organization. This was a very important piece of evidence that we presented. And actually, the adjudicator on this case, he asked the minister this question, the minister representative, to be exact. She said, Mr. Figueroa had stated that there are some resolutions concerning FMLN from the United Nations Security Council, and in neither of those they refer to FMLN as a terrorist organization. So do you have any comment on that? What was the response from the minister representative? You know, her response was just, well, the adjudicator just interrupted her and said, I guess that's too broad. I don't think that you can comment on that. And he goes, I think that we don't know what those resolutions were about. You know, here, when he said that, he just falls into a contradiction, because I presented those resolutions in the tribunal as evidence, which means that the adjudicator himself, he hadn't even read the resolutions, the evidence that I provided. He was just relying on the information that was being given by the ministry representative. So really, this doesn't make any sense.
Mm-hmm. And you referred to the peace agreement, and that was made in January 16th, 1992, and that, the peace agreement, recognized officially that the FMLN was a legitimate political opposition. And prior to 1992, the FMLN was categorized as a terrorist group due to biased evidence available at the time. But as you mentioned also, in 1992, the UN Truth Commission report detailed just that publication talked about the truth of the conflict in El Salvador, and that the military dictatorship then was that it was very violent, and there was horrendous killings by that Salvadorian government with over 70,000 civilian deaths. And so basically the publication of the UN Truth Report helped spread more around the globe, made it more known around the globe that the El Salvador government was responsible for the majority of the human rights abuses. And so it's completely inappropriate that the Canadian government currently is and continues to refer to the FMLN as a terrorist organization.
You know, one statement that should be considered would be this: no terrorist government, no terrorist organization. The Truth Commission clearly says some statistics, and we presented this as evidence also during our proceedings. 85%, as you said, of the atrocities that were committed during the Civil War were committed by agents of the state, 5% by FMLN, and the other 10% were basically attributed maybe to the death squads, which in the long run is going to tell you that 95% of the atrocities of the conflict were committed by members of the state and 5 by the FMLN. So if you want to look at this from just a mathematic perspective, who will be more likely to be labeled as a terrorist? But I think that that definition of terrorism had to be, I think from now on, should be used a little more, with some more being more cautious about using it. In some ways, I believe that the definition, we have an urgent need to deconstruct the definition of terrorism, because it's being misapplied to many people. I want to refer a little bit about the Truth Commission. You know, during the proceedings, the minister representative, she presented only 56 pages of the Truth Commission. On the other hand, we presented the whole document as evidence in this case. Why did we do that? It's because the Truth Commission, it cannot be seen as pieces here and pieces there. That if you read the Truth Commission is a very complete document. It gives you so many clues. As a matter of fact, because it was done by the United Nations in the environment of peace and with the people providing evidence freely on this, and basically that report hasn't been refuted neither by the FMLN nor the government of El Salvador of that time, nor even by the United States of America. And there's a reason why I say that. Those conditions basically can tell you that this Truth Commission can be used as evidence, a reliable evidence, and it has been used in many, many cases. But the minister representative only presented 56 pages. How can you be objective on this situation when you are just presenting part of the story? In order to be objective on the story of El Salvador, you need to basically see the whole context. See? And if I guess that's why we presented the whole document as evidence, opposed to what the minister has been presented just partial. They have been trying to force FMLN into a definition that it doesn't fit.
So this flip-flopping by the Canadian government in labeling the FMLN as a terrorist organization, and then at certain times not, and being supportive of the FMLN, seems like the Canadian government's being very deceiving. Does this have something to do with why the Salvadorian government hasn't commented on your deportation order?
Well, I cannot really comment on the reasons why the Salvadoran government hasn't come with a response to this kind of allegations. We have been dealing with this situation for over a year, and it has taken us a long time to gather so much more information about the case that we can understand even better. So I would assume that for the Salvadoran government, somehow it will be much more difficult to gather all of this information. There's the barrier of the language, for instance, the distance, and the fact that they have been receiving information from the Canadian government. And, how can they explain that this big contradiction that exists between the executive and the judiciary? When the Canadian government, the judiciary has been basically leveling FMLN as a terrorist organization. There are so many other cases where they clearly says the FMLN is a terrorist organization, and when the executive of Canada, they know about this because cases are being brought for them through admissibility for the Section 34.2. But if we review on the statistics, there are not many cases of the Section 34.2 that are being positive on these cases. And when the Canadian government, basically with that, they are basically reaffirming, they are assuring that the decisions of the judiciary are true. So I think that somehow the Salvadoran government doesn't understand that indeed the Canadian government is stating that El Salvador is full with terrorists. So I would say that right now at this point that the dignity of many Salvadorans is at stake in this situation. I am not a terrorist. I don't think FMLN is a terrorist. Then why are they calling FMLN a terrorist?
Sorry, I'm just going to expand on my question. So I just asked this because it's plausible that Canada could be using the word terrorist, using it in certain situations to not harm the relationship with the Salvadorian government. So is acting one way, possibly labeling the current Salvadorian government as terrorist behind that Salvadorian government's back, but when they are dealing with the Salvadorian government more directly, are careful to not indicate that they have done that.
You know, if the Canadian government wouldn't be labeling FMLN as a terrorist organization, it will be very logical that these kind of allegations wouldn't exist. Wouldn't you think so? It's just a simple matter of applying a little bit of logic on this situation. So I guess that's an answer to the Salvadoran government. You know, in 2009, on June 2009, Eugenio Chicas, a judge from El Salvador, a commander of FMLN, he was invited into Canada for a conference. He was detained at an airport in Toronto by CBSA officers with the same allegations. So as a result of that, the Canadian government issued an apology to the Salvadoran government about the incident. So this is really something that stresses the contradiction that exists within the system. They don't really have a clear definition of what terrorist is, you know.
So besides causing hardships for yourself and your family, how does your case affect many other people, including many Canadians, most particularly immigrants, and people who are not of Salvadorian background?
Well, I think that the implications of this to the Canadians, these are big. I have to mention that my case is not unique. There have been in the past, and they are being, people from FMLN are being brought for admissibility hearings right now, as we speak. And it's not only people from FMLN. It's people from FSLN in Nicaragua, people from EEL from Mexico, from Zapatistas, there are many other organizations that are being labeled the same. And, well, they are being brought on this situation, but they are somehow generalizing. So anybody who is a member of any organization that stands against a brutal regime, or they are standing for their rights, can be labeled as terrorist. So basically, that's a very dangerous message that the Canadian government is sending to many people around the world. What they are saying is, you people, if you are being repressed, please don't stand up for your rights, because you could be labeled as terrorist here in Canada and you will be deemed inadmissible. So the problem here is basically that the immigration law and the way it is being applied is so broad. Archbishop Romero, and the day before he was assassinated in March 1980, he mentioned something about a message to the soldiers and to the National Guard. In one part of this message, he says, an immoral law doesn't have to be obeyed. And when a law is affecting human rights, I think that makes that law immoral. So this is something for people to think over, you know. The rights of many people, my family has undergone for many, many years, lots of hardship. And I think that we don't want this kind of situation to happen to many other people. So people need to understand that something needs to be done.
Canada likes to boast about being a very welcoming place for people who are seeking refuge, and for being inclusive of all people, regardless of class or ethnic background. Your case signals something opposite of this long-standing Canadian image, and supposedly of utmost importance to Canadian values are civil liberties and democracy.
You know, Canada has had a heritage of welcoming people that have been persecuted around the world. Canada is a country that is constituted by immigrants. And there are people from many, many countries. Many of those that came years and years ago, they were members of people that fought against, for instance, the Nazis in that situation. And basically, what is happening is, like, because the way the law is interpreted, they talk about membership to a certain organization. Some judges, they said, it doesn't matter how long, how much time it has passed. A member is a member. So would that mean that all of a sudden somebody will be bringing people that fought against the Nazis to admissibility hearings? Or just the case of Nelson Mandela, for instance. It's just so much contradiction on this situation.
What is the We Are Jose campaign?
Well, the We Are Jose campaign was conceived by a group of students from the University of British Columbia. And after we went there for a teaching event, and well, basically it was created by Canadians in response to this injustice that is being done on my family. We Are Jose, basically what its intention is, basically to say, you know, anybody can be affected by the way the law is stated and how it is applied. So anybody could be Jose. Jose could be a Mexican. Jose could be a Chilean. Jose could be a Russian. Jose could be anybody that has stood up for rights, and that's the concept. And that's a way to try to raise some consciousness on people, that people need to basically put their thoughts, put their heads together, and basically speak up. Archbishop Romero became the voice of the voiceless, and he has been present in this process. And I guess that in some way, that's something that we would like to do with the We Are Jose campaign.
How have people all across Canada been responding to news of your deportation?
Well, I think that we have been having so much support. When we received these allegations, we were basically alone. I was confused a year ago about what is this bringing, this situation. I didn't have any legal representation, so I asked the pastor of my church, Walnut Grove Lutheran Church, to represent me on this case. I knew that if I was going to these proceedings by myself, a judge wouldn't just listen to me. And I needed somebody who was a Canadian so that what I had to say was to be listened. And I think Pastor Carl Keller, he has been a blessing on this situation. Now he understands the situation very much in this situation. And ever since we started the We Are Jose campaign, we have been having so much feed on information and support. Many people have manifested their support many ways. We started this tour for across Canada with no money in Vancouver, but people has been moving us from places to places. They have been able to listen to us. We went to Kamloops, Calgary, Regina, talk to people. That's where we need to go. Talk to Canadians and explain the situation. And obviously, it has taken us a very short time to arrive from Vancouver to Toronto and to Guelph right now. And we could have made it if Canadians wouldn't have been supporting us. And I have to thank people from Regina, people from many places where we have been going. I would like to say, for instance, in Kamloops, we met a lady. She was listening while I was talking with some librarians in a public library in Kamloops. And a week after, I learned that she had written a letter to the Minister of Public Safety. And actually, the Minister of Public Safety has already responded to her letter. He states in that letter that he cannot comment anything on this situation because the Privacy Act forbids him to make any comments without my approval. Well, I don't think people would need my approval. I'm going to be given this person that wrote this letter my signed consent, so she can continue asking the minister about this situation. I know they will not listen to me because I am just a foreign national, but hopefully they can listen to my son, who is a Canadian. Hopefully they can listen to many other Canadians that they are worried about the future of my kids, that their rights are not being upheld.
Yes, your son, Jose Ivan, is traveling with you on this tour across Canada that started on March 18th, 2011. What can listeners do to support you?
Well, I think that one of the things that people can do, the same way as Jennifer from Kamloops wrote a letter to the minister, just write letters to the minister to basically tackle this situation. And so that they can give a response. The more letters they write in a regular way, well, the Canadian government will have to listen to somebody. Somebody there will be listened, and they probably will be doing something. Right now, we started this trip as a way to raise awareness on the population, on the Canadians. And, well, as soon as you get this, spread the word. That's the only way that they can do something about this. Do you have questions? You know, I am willing to answer any questions that any Canadian ask me about this situation. I think that the main thing it has to be is like the immigration problem is a very wide problem that needs to be solved. And the way that it could be solved is basically by trying to do something with what is causing this problem. Ask what the problem is on the immigration law. What's the problem with this? I still cannot understand why they have brought these allegations against FMLN, basically. Because if you read the decision of the judge in this case, he doesn't find anything wrong on my actions. He's just deporting me merely because I was a member of FMLN and because he thinks that FMLN fits into the definition of terrorism that they have, which I do not agree. So there are many things right now. More likely, we would like some efforts to cover our legal fees for this. It's taken us, during all this time, my family is being dragged to economically, physically, emotionally. So we need the support of as many people as possible. And the only way I can say is just raise my voice in this situation. So we would like more Canadians to raise their voice as well with us. And like I said, there will be some requirements on this situation, and we can do a lot of things that will benefit not only Salvadorans, but many other communities.
There's also one way that people in BC had decided to help with providing support for your case is that students at the Simon Fraser University created a 20-minute documentary that you can find online. And so just search online for the Simon Fraser University documentary about Jose's case. Yes, and just search with the term Simon Fraser University We Are Jose documentary. So that's one way, creating more media coverage on the case, highlighting it through media. And I like how you referred to one of the root problems, which is the law, because obviously it's affecting so many people in a way that it's harming many people and violating their human rights. And so I like how you had made that connection that therefore it's immoral what's happening, how the immigration law could be misused in this way. Another way that people, listeners, can help with your case is to also think about deconstructing the definition of terrorism and what the mainstream media and the state, Western states, define as terrorism.
Well, I think it's very important to basically create some discussion among not only Canadians, but around the world about trying to redefine this definition. It's very problematic. What there are freedom fighters for some other people, for others are terrorists. And I do not think that there's a universal agreement on what terrorism is. And that's basically something that needs to be addressed.
There's an increasing pattern of criminalizing immigrants, especially the more vulnerable immigrants, the working poor migrants, especially who have precarious status or even no status here in Canada. And the law itself is a criminalizing process. So it's really needed that people who have the power to change this immigration infrastructure or system, to not allow our immigration system to continue to create suffering and stereotype the more vulnerable immigrants as criminals, when this can be avoided.
You know, if we take our case, let's take the case of FMLN. Some months ago, Jackie Rivera, a member of FMLN, presented to the Salvadoran legislature a piece of correspondence asking for incorporating the possibility of Salvadorans abroad to be able to vote in elections. Now, let's put that in the context of Canadian society and the law here in Canada. So, if a law like that, allowing Salvadorans to vote abroad, is approved in El Salvador, that would mean that FMLN will have their, because their diaspora of over 150,000 Salvadorans here in Canada. So FMLN will have to make some kind of elections campaign here. But how could that be if the membership of FMLN is considered is being criminalized? You know, so there will be a contradiction between the Canadian law and the Salvadoran law. So this is something that you apply a little bit of the logic, you know, in some ways, the section 34.1 and the way it has been applied is basically banning any membership to FMLN, apply it to the Canadian Constitution. Well, there is in one section of the Canadian Constitution, it guarantees the freedom of opinion, the freedom of having a political opinion. And, well, if people are not allowed to basically talk about this FMLN as a political party, well, wouldn't that make sense that they are really contradicting the Constitution? You know, it's something very problematic.
I know literally the Minister of Immigration and the Minister of Public Safety could just take 30 seconds, even less, to grant you the exemption and granting you permanent residency here. However, they are currently choosing not to. So what's the time frame in which people who would like to support your campaign should we should act?
Well, as we said, the Ministerial Relief application, the application for the exemption, and also the HNC application, it will take the minister just 30 seconds to decide and sign a paper and say this person is admissible into Canada. But we have got some statistics that it would take the Minister of Public Safety 7 to 9 years to decide on an application of such nature. And that's really troublesome, you know. Why would somebody let a family undergo for so much waiting and in the end saying, you know, you just get out of this country? Where is the humanity expressed on this situation?
Part of the We Are Jose campaign is calling for support through raising money in order to realize this tour. And you mentioned that there's money needed to be raised for your legal case.
Well, I think that in order to make this trip to Ottawa from Langley, basically I lost my job. I requested for some time off to make this trip, and I was given the option, do this trip or lose your job. And under these circumstances, well, you know, I cannot have my family to be living in such, in this situation much longer. We need Canadian support in order to have a solution for this faster. And that's one of the reasons why we are making this trip, to raise awareness of the situation. And obviously, we have incurred into so many legal costs. Even right now, as we speak, we owe the lawyer that is attending on this situation that made the application for ministerial relief over $6,000. And that's something that is harming my family. And, well, actually, we are just asking for people for help. Archbishop Romero once says, the law is like a snake, only bites the barefooted. And with that is meant that justice can be only be accessed by people that have the means to buy justice. Well, if that's the case, well, I think that justice cannot be achieved without the support of the community. And right now, that's what we would like to ask people to. But the most important thing for us is that people can raise their voices with us. Only that way we can basically raise more awareness on the situation.
And how can people find out more about the campaign?
Well, we have our website, www.wearejose.com. That will link you to some other websites where we have a lot of information. People can send emails to wearejose@gmail.com. And also give us a ring at 778-839-JOSE. We are willing to talk to as many people as we can in order to raise more awareness.
And do invite Jose to speak in your community. Contact wearejose@gmail.com to do that. Well, thank you for your courage and your ethic and for continuing to speak out against repressive state actions.
Well, what is moving me here is, you know, I can just see my little kids. They need a future, and their future is being threatened in here. And as a father, I cannot allow that to happen, and that's what's moving me. It's something that any parent will do for their kids, and I'll do whatever it takes in order to guarantee that their rights are being upheld.
Thank you so much.
Thank you to you.